From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
President Trump announced he will end the DACA program in 6 months, subjecting unauthorized immigrants who have lived most of their lives in the United States to risk of deportation. But then he said he wants Congress to send him a law to protect DACA recipients, and that if they don't, he will revisit the issue. What does any of that mean? We'll discuss. Plus, Trump threw congressional Republicans under the bus with a deal with his new friends Chuck and Nancy on the debt limit, government spending, and Harvey relief. Is this the pivot? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, congressional reporter Haley Byrd of the Independent Journal Review will tell us how the Trump and Chuck and Nancy show is changing the way Congress works. And Emily Yaffe of The Atlantic will join us to discuss Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's announcement that she will revisit Obama-era rules on campus sex assault. That's up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Ross Douthat, opinion columnist for The New York Times. And our special guest is Mickey Kaus, longtime political blogger at KausFiles.com. We're going to get to Trump and Chuck and Nancy, but first, this was a really odd week in immigration politics. On Tuesday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that Trump's administration will end DACA. That's the program created by an Obama executive order that offers work permits and protection against deportation to unauthorized immigrants who arrived in the United States as children. But they're not ending the program yet. Trump says it's illegal, but he'll keep it running for 6 months and that he wants Congress to do its job and produce a legislative fix in the meantime. But it's not clear what Trump means by do your job. Nancy Pelosi says the president told her he wants to quickly sign a version of the DREAM Act, which would legalize roughly the same set of people currently protected under DACA. But Republicans in Congress are hesitant to legalize hundreds of thousands of unauthorized immigrants. And Trump has been vague about what policies to restrict immigration he'd want to see paired with a legislative version of DACA if he were to sign it. On Thursday, Trump nonetheless tweeted that DACA recipients have, quote, nothing to worry about, at least for the next 6 months. What happens after, who knows? So I'm genuinely confused about what's going on here, whether, you know, Trump is sincere when he ends DACA or Trump is sincere when he says he wants a legislative replacement for DACA. Katrina, where are we?
Well, it's not clear what Trump means. This is not new. I mean, there's an incoherence on when he speaks about a number of issues, including North Korea in this last week. But I mean, he put out Jeff Sessions to kill DACA. I mean, it's not only immoral, cruel, but they were trying to sell it with junk economics. I'm sure Mickey disagrees, but claiming dreamers take American jobs. No, they're not doing that. Truth is that letting dreamers work legally helps the U.S. economy. Letting dreamers stay is the position of many GOP leaders. So I think it's important to stop calling it a left, a Democratic position. I think it's a common sense, humane position. There are a number of bills circulating around Congress. And I think, you know, you could see, I think you need 24 Republicans to sign on for a bill to protect the dreamers to win. Let's not forget, Congress is more unpopular than Trump. So there's a game. There's a game, a dance at work here. We can get to the next game with Chuck and Nancy. But it's not clear. But people are living in fear and anxiety. That's a bottom line.
Well, the thing is, it's also, at least officially, Donald Trump's position to protect the dreamers at the same time that he is taking
steps that create this anxiety and the turbulence.
Mickey, what do you think? Do you think the president is sincere when he's ending the program, or do you think he's sincere when he's saying that he's looking for Congress to send him a permanent version of it?
Well, his position isn't that crazy. I mean, he thinks the program is illegal, which arguably it is, but he thinks it should be preserved legislatively, which he's trying to do. The big issue is, does he get anything in exchange for making the exemption the Dreamers get formal? He seems eager to do a deal and willing to settle for, you know, my side, which is the immigration restrictionist side. We're worried that he'll give it all up for a few miles of wall. He doesn't even seem to be holding out for that. The key point is that speed is of the essence here. The history of these things is they start out with a lot of head of steam, and then the opponents work the phones and they stop it. That's why Nancy Pelosi wants to move so quickly, and why it was encouraging from the restrictionist point of view that Paul Ryan said it would take months, because in months you can kill it.
Ross, what do you think is the outlook?
Oh, my goodness, I have no idea. I mean, I think the underlying, and as with everything related to Trump and Congress, the best the safest thing to bet on is gridlock and nothing actually getting done. And the biggest obstacle to anything getting done is the fact that Paul Ryan has been in the past wary of bringing anything to a vote on the floor that doesn't have majority Republican support. It's a sort of modified version of the old Hastert rule that you wanted things to have a majority of the majority support before you vote on them. So that's been in part what's kept anything to do with DACA and the Dreamers from coming to a vote before. And it's entirely possible, depending on where the pressure points are, that it will happen again. The reality is that Trump's official position here, somewhat unusually for him, is entirely coherent, right? It's entirely reasonable to say, and indeed, Obama's own public statements on these issues point in the same direction, that that sort of unilateral executive amnesties are possibly unconstitutional and shouldn't be pursued. And if Congress wants to offer a form of amnesty for a particularly sympathetic group of illegal immigrants, it should do so through the legislative process. So that's a coherent position. The question is there an actual Trump White House strategy to get to a point where Congress does something? I don't think we should expect that at all.
Strategy? Well, Trump White House? I mean, I was going to say Washington.
Well, there are different
in deal making and talk about deal making. And I do think my former colleague Mike Tomasky has a good New York Times op-ed today, which is you're going to hear quickly swap DACA for wall funding. And he argues, though he is someone who's often on the pragmatic tactical side, it would be a big mistake for Democrats to do that.
Why? Isn't the wall expensive symbolism, whereas DACA would be a real significant achievement?
You have 58% of people supporting Dreamers, and Americans' majorities do not support a border wall. And, you know, it's kind of a thing for pundits to say obstruction is a bad deal or think tankers. But in fact, voters really punish it, often reward it. And I think it'd be a big mistake for Democrats to move that route.
But you can't have it both ways then. You can't go out, as Democrats are doing, and say, this is a slam dunk moral issue where people are living in fear for their lives.
I agree.
And it is absolutely morally urgent to get this done, and then say, but we won't make a single concession to get it done. Right? I mean, then you're saying we don't really care about the Dreamers either, but since we see a political opportunity here.
No, I think as for the Dreamers, Democrats can find other ways to help them. And I think as the 6-month deadline approaches, hue and cry is going to be thunderous. And I think we haven't even talked about 2018. The wall is so odious. Maybe more security funding, but border funding, but the wall.
Doesn't it depend what we mean by the wall? I mean, because the way I see
security,
there'll be a physical barrier on a lot of the border already has a physical barrier. You'd build some more of it, and Republicans would get to call the thing a wall, and Democrats would say no, it's a fence. It feels like, I mean, building a literal concrete wall along the entire 2,000 plus miles of the border through Big Bend Canyon is ridiculous, and I don't think that'll get done.
But you open it up to $1.5 billion. Next, it's what? It's anteed up, and you lose. Democrats lose the principled case against Trump's wall. They don't lose the principal case against the Dreamers. And by the way, even members of Trump's own dwindling base are not as opposed to the Dreamers. Put aside many prominent Republicans. So,
well, how about E-Verify? What if you traded it? I'm going to speak Mickey's language for a minute. Could you trade? So do you have a particular objection to the wall? Would you trade Dreamer status for some other enforcement mechanism around illegal immigration? E-Verify being an obvious example.
I think the wall is a place where you just stop and you just say no. I mean,
it's become
the identitarian, xenophobic, ugly expression emblematic of the Trump administration and its minions.
Well, that's fine. Let's switch the compromise then to legalize the Dreamers and have this E-Verify system, which is a computerized check of all new hires so employers don't hire undocumented people. Which was endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce last time. Now, of course, they're opposed. Plus some restriction on the ability of every immigrant to bring in their uncles and aunts and distant relatives. So the number of the so-called chain migration, where whole villages move here, is curtailed. And forget the wall for now. And why not do that deal?
Mickey, I think the problem here is that so much of this is about the president's psychology. The president really wants the wall. The president, it's important symbolism for him. Now, I think, you know, again, as I say, it depends on exactly what we mean physically by the wall. But I think it's possible for the wall to be important to the president and for it to be, you know, just a few miles of fence to Democrats who can be proud that they got DACA.
I like the wall, but the president isn't the only player here. He's told Nancy Pelosi he's going to sign a bill. He's tried to give away as much negotiating leverage as he can, but there are people in Congress who might not give him a bill if it doesn't have some enforcement measures like E-Verify and some they want to go beyond it, not just enforcement measures, because traditionally the enforcement measures don't happen, some way to actually curtail this chain migration.
I want to talk about one other aspect of this DACA story, which is the interview that Steve Bannon gave this week to Charlie Rose of CBS News, where Steve Bannon had this to say about statements in defense of DACA from Catholic officials, including particularly Cardinal Timothy Dolan, who's the Archbishop of New York.
The Catholic Church has been terrible about this.
Okay, fair.
The bishops have been terrible about this. By the way, you know why? You know why? Because unable to really to come to grips with the problems in the church, they need illegal aliens. They need illegal aliens to fill the churches. It's obvious on the face of it. That's what the entire Catholic bishops condemning. They have an economic interest. They have an economic interest in unlimited immigration, unlimited illegal immigration.
Ross, you're a Catholic with some opinions about the way the church involves itself in political disputes. What did you make of this?
I mean, it's wrong and a libel, I would say, that as often is the case with libels, a sort of interesting point, an interesting true point connected to it. The libel is the claim that the bishops are motivated by economic self-interest, by the desire to keep their coffers full and so on in their support for immigrants. And that's false. And the church's support for immigrants, for some kind of right to migrate and so on, is not just a development of liberal modernity. It goes back very far in Catholic tradition, as Catholic Democrats rightly point out, I think. You know, personally, I think that could be tempered more, but I do think that there's sort of both sincere theological reasons and sort of inevitable personal sociological reasons why the Catholic bishops are supportive of the Dreamers and other immigrant groups. They have personal contact in their pews and parishes and communities and so on with a lot of Hispanic Catholics. And that kind of personal contact, added to the theological and moral reasons to support migrants' rights, suffice to explain without sort of lurching into the most cynical explanation. That being said, Bannon is correct that the Catholic Church does sort of sociologically right now depend on Hispanic immigration to sort of maintain its relative stability in mass attendance. The Catholic Church has lost many, many white native-born American churchgoers over the last 40 years and has made up for it with immigrant communicants, although it has also done in many cases a poor job of keeping immigrants Catholic. A lot of the most sort of religiously intense
Pentecostals.
Hispanic immigrants, yeah, exactly, have converted to evangelicalism or Pentecostalism. So there's a really genuinely complicated underlying sociological story there, but it isn't really the aspersions on the motivations of bishops, I think, are at least 87% false.
I don't.
10% of bishops are cynics. When I think of Steve, in any age of Catholicism.
Yeah. When I think of Steve Bannon, I don't think of complexity and analytical framework. I mean, you know, this is not the first time the Trump team has fired at Catholics and the Pope back at the Trump team. I'm not shocked. Nothing shocks me when it comes to Bannon, that someone could be so openly hostile to immigrants, unable to grasp the possibility people might genuinely sympathize with the plight of immigrants. But, you know, don't forget the Pope and the president have not had an easy relationship. In February of last year, Pope condemned Trump's hardline immigration agenda and suggested such stances did not match the values of Christianity. And they, you know, Trump fired back, as is his wont, saying it's disgraceful. I think what Bannon said was disgraceful, though. You know, there is a grain of truth, and it's true in Latin America as well, where the church and its membership is shifting radically, and it's losing many in Latin America to evangelical churches and to Pentecostalism. But for Bannon, this is just red meat for
I think one thing, though, and I'm interested to hear Mickey's thoughts on this, because while I do think Steve Bannon's views on this are reflective of a substantial number of white Catholics in the United States, Eugene Scott from The Washington Post pointed out a poll this week showing that white Catholics are about evenly divided on the question of whether immigrants strengthen America or not. Trump cleaned up with white Catholics, got about 60% of their votes, which was an unusually strong performance for a Republican candidate. Mickey, what do you think?
Well, there may be a split between American Catholics and the Vatican here. The I would like to, reading the bishop's
statement. Or white American Catholics,
right,
anyway.
Yeah. Reading the bishop's, right, traditional, whatever, non-immigrants or non-recent immigrant. I would like to, reading the bishop's statement, I didn't quite see where there was a border that they would approve of. And if you look at the demographic trends, there's a huge population boom in Africa. There are going to be billions of people who are going to want to go somewhere. They're probably not going to be able to feed themselves. And it's of immense consequence if the church doesn't believe in borders and thinks everybody should be able to go everywhere because we always welcome the stranger. I don't think they've really grappled with that part of the consequences of their thinking.
No, we're going to take. I agree with.
Go ahead, quickly,
I agree with Mickey. Just quickly, I agree with Mickey there that there is that the bishops, and I think more so in Europe than the United States, where the dynamics are rather different, there is a danger, absolutely, of sort of Christian principle being turned into a kind of sentimental unrealism about what migration can do to societies. I still think, though, in the particular case of the debate about Dreamers, bishops are not sitting around sort of, you know, counting the dollars that extra illegal immigrants bring into their, that's very low on the list of reasons why they're taking the position that they do.
Yeah, maybe compassion has something to do with it.
We're going to take a quick break. Up ahead, Congress is back in session and the president has a new productive relationship with Chuck and Nancy. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider. As you may have seen, congressional leaders went to the White House on Thursday to hash out a few things that have to happen this month: relief funding for Hurricane Harvey, an increase in the federal debt limit, and funding to keep the government open past September 30. Republican leaders wanted a big debt limit increase to cover the government for the next 18 months so they wouldn't have to vote on raising it again until after next year's elections. But at the White House meeting, President Trump stunned everyone by siding with Democrats, who were demanding a short increase just through mid-December. Afterward, Trump talked about how productively he's working with Chuck and Nancy. I guess the president and Democratic leaders are on a warm first-name basis now. The president's not calling him crying Chuck Schumer anymore. I'm going to welcome a new guest now to brief my panel and you on how this is landing on Capitol Hill and what it means for what Congress will do over the next few months. Haley Byrd is the congressional reporter for the Independent Journal Review, and she's been on Capitol Hill for this fairly exciting week. Haley, how are Republicans in Congress reacting to this deal?
Well, obviously, they're not really pleased with it. I think pretty much in the morning before that meeting with Chuck and Nancy that Donald had, Paul Ryan himself was calling such a deal ridiculous and attacking the notion of doing a three-month continuing resolution and a three-month debt ceiling hike. So Republicans clearly aren't pleased, but I think the group that's most unhappy right here are conservatives who, when it was only party line votes and no negotiations between the parties were happening, conservatives were wielding like a large amount of power. With only 36 members of the House Freedom Caucus, they were able to exercise a lot of control over the Republican agenda. But when you have Donald Trump having conversations with his friends Chuck and Nancy, that sort of takes away their power to have their say on the agenda. So, of course, Republicans aren't really happy or enthused with this situation.
Why do Republicans think a short-term debt limit increase is unfavorable to them?
Well, it's mostly about timing. So debt ceiling debates can get sort of unruly and painful for the party. And when you have it right before Christmas, when everyone wants to go home, it sort of makes the other items that they want to work on more difficult to do because you're going to have that on the calendar that you're going to have to deal with. And they want to get tax reform done before the end of the year. So
right. So there's a number of these things on the agenda. You have tax reform. Obviously, this discussion over some sort of DACA fix and maybe some broader changes on immigration are on the agenda. And so can you walk through how this December standoff might play out? Because my sense is that both Democrats and Republicans think Democrats are going to have a lot of leverage in December to make demands about what else gets done at the time that they do some longer government funding deal and raise the debt ceiling again.
So I'm not entirely sure how it's going to play out, but there are concerns, like you said, that Democrats are going to have a large negotiating hand, at least to make demands. It really depends on what level of interest there is for the Republicans in dealing with immigration, like you said. But you do have, you know, the administration threatening to shut down the government over the wall funding. I'm sure that will come up as well. You're going to have a surveillance showdown happening with FISA Section 702 reauthorization before the end of the year. And they all want to get tax reform done by the end of the year, which is shaping up to be a challenge. So the debt ceiling debate is going to play into a lot of these different discussions that are going to be happening throughout the fall.
There's been some noise about a last-ditch revival of the health care repeal bill in the Senate. Because of Senate rules, they have to pass it by September 30th if they're going to pass it at all. Do you think that there's a likelihood that that's going to happen?
I don't think it's very likely at this point. I've heard sort of murmurings from the Cassidy Graham proposal that it's sort of a last-ditch effort. But what's more likely, they held hearings in the Senate in the HELP committee this week for a bipartisan short-term market fix. And there have been, I think, productive conversations between members from both parties about a healthcare bill that would deal with market stabilization and maybe help decrease some of those premium hikes that they're expecting to see in 2018. That's looking more likely than a last-ditch repeal effort at this point.
There have also been some rumblings about a challenge to Paul Ryan's speakership and some discontent, as you described, from conservatives. Do you think Paul Ryan's job is in danger at all?
I spoke with Mark Meadows earlier this week.
Mark Meadows is the head of the House Freedom Caucus, that conservative
yes.
group in the House.
So conservatives, they do have concerns and they are frustrated with the agenda for sure at this point. I don't know how valid those discussions are about replacing Speaker Ryan at this point, but there was this quote from Meadows, and he said, you know, at this point, Americans, what they care about is getting something done. They would vote for Mickey Mouse to be speaker if he got something done. So I can't really speak to Paul Ryan, like the security of Paul Ryan's job, but I can speak to the fact that conservatives are frustrated with how this session has gone so far.
I've been talking with Haley Byrd. She's the congressional reporter for Independent General Review. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's bring Ross, Katrina, and Mickey back into the conversation now. That's on the left, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation. On the right, Ross Douthat, columnist for The New York Times, and our special guest, Mickey Kaus of KausFiles.com. So this sounds to me actually like Congress is getting more functional and Congress's relationship with the president is getting more functional, that there's more bipartisan conversations, maybe even something about healthcare stabilization. The president was able to, instead of having a last minute showdown over a government shutdown or the debt limit, we are, you know, several weeks before there has to be an agreement. One has been reached. Isn't this Washington working more as it's supposed to and, you know, the parties working together?
I wish I could agree with you, Josh. I mean, I think, you know, we've known Trump's worldview is transactional, situational, not ideological, and there are openings here. But I suggest a wait-and-see stance. I sort of play on what Reagan used to say, trust but verify. I'd say test, verify, distrust. I hope Schumer or Chuck and Nancy know not to trust Trump and the way Ryan and McConnell did. There's a Trump triangulation at work here. There's jujitsu trying to neuter the Freedom Caucus. But I think there are no indications of any meaningful change on Trump's part on some big issues. Sure, as Haley said, Democrats may have been handed more leverage to play with the next round of talks. But where's the sustained shift in strategy? I mean, take Obamacare sabotage. That may well continue. The fate of the Dreamers, what price will Trump try to extract? Infrastructure spending and taxes. You know more about this, Josh, but I think the good news is Trump's deal may put tax reform in peril.
I think that's right. I think this makes tax reform harder, but I think it makes some other things that Democrats might be involved in, like infrastructure, immigration. I think those things get a little bit easier. Ross, what did you make of this week?
I mean, I think it's a hint of the alternate reality where Trump would have been I'm saying would have been, because I think it's very unlikely at this point, a successful president. I think it was pretty clear from when he first came into office that there was a version of Trumpism that could be reasonably popular and successful by peeling off some Democratic votes in red states for bills that annoyed Republicans but didn't do so enough to make them want to challenge the president. And, you know, this would have been a world where Trump started with infrastructure and didn't go as far as the Republicans tried to go on Obamacare repeal and replace, and, you know, tried to push the most middle-class-friendly tax reform package possible and looked for sustained deal-making on immigration, sort of real horse trading and so on. All of that could theoretically still happen. It just seems to me that, one, what we've seen from Trump suggests he doesn't have the capacity really to do it, because you actually have to have attention to detail. And two, his massive unpopularity and his sort of repeated lurch into, you know, grotesqueries and ridiculousness gives the Democrats less and less incentive to make big deals. So it seems to me that what you could see is a DC where you don't have the kind of, you know, debt ceiling showdowns and fiscal cliff showdowns and so on that you had constantly under Obama, where sort of the budgets year to year get done a little more sort of, you know, a little more in advance of the deadlines and so on. That seems to me the most likely best case scenario in terms of a Washington is working future. But it still doesn't get you to a world where you're doing big bipartisan deals on anything. I still have a hard time seeing how we get there.
Mickey, I can sort of imagine a world in which Donald Trump does deals with Democrats that make Mickey Kaus very happy, and I can also imagine him doing deals with Democrats that make Mickey Kaus very unhappy.
Well, right. I wish he had chosen the issue on which to make this long-awaited move to be one that he campaigned on. He didn't campaign on giving amnesty to Dreamers. He campaigned on cracking down and controlling the borders. That said. I think I wish he'd done it earlier before he wasted the first year of his presidency. But it does seem to me there's some possibility of something like an Obamacare stabilization that he would push through with a left-right coalition. So there's some possibility. And the problem here is he's shown a comical oversensitivity to what the press and the New York Times say about him. And, you know, people are waiting for him to pivot back and to betray.
Not my columns, man.
But okay.
Nobody, come on. Well, he doesn't. I was.
He actually reads the New York Times editorials. He may be the last person in America to do that. And you know, the press is never going to praise him for going to the right on issues like immigration. So if he's comically, addicted to positive press coverage, he's never going to betray Chuck and Nancy on that issue.
Yeah, but Mickey, there's an alternate media universe which Trump seems to pay more attention to, which does praise him. And it's growing. I mean, it's Sinclair. I mean, if you believe in local communities and localism, if that Sinclair Lewis merger goes through, I think with Tribune, you're going to see a lot more sort of Coke-written newscasts. You got Breitbart going, you got Fox, and that's what he's watching.
I'm not sure that this is what he pays more attention to. I mean, it's clear he watches a lot of Fox News,
yes.
He watches Fox and Friends, and he watches a lot of CNN, which you can tell because he gets so angry about what happens on CNN, and he reads the New York Times, and he reads the Washington Post coverage of him. I think he cares about both parts of the media, and the reason I've come to think that they are going to get a DACA deal done is that, first of all, you know, Trump campaigned and said that he would revoke DACA immediately. And he didn't. There's some reason why he waited around for months and months until his hand was forced. He did this basically because Jeff Sessions told him he wouldn't defend the program because all these Republican state attorneys general were going to sue over the program. It doesn't look...
So you think he cares? He cares about the court of public opinion on this issue.
I do. And I also, I think this is a subtle distinction people are missing. I think the president is prejudiced against Mexican people. I don't think he hates all Mexican people. I think a lot of people who indulge in racial and ethnic stereotypes, he has this idea of good Mexicans and bad Mexicans. And when he gave that very first speech in the campaign, he talked about, you know, they're sending drugs and rapists, and some of them, I assume, are good people. I think he has that framework, and I think the DACA recipients are not the focus of his, you know, of his fear and anger about immigration. I think he thinks of these as the good ones. So I don't think he's motivated by the need for a DREAM Act, but I don't think he was motivated by a desire to deport DREAMers. I think he understands that the politics of the issue are bad for him. And I also think a really telling thing was he tweeted this week about, you know, that Congress should send me a bill on this, which Obama was never able to get done. Trump loves doing things that Obama wasn't able to do. And if he did this, not only would he get great press coverage, for the very first time, Democrats and the mainstream media would give him credit for accomplishing something that President Obama wasn't able to accomplish. Well, I think he craves that and would like it a lot.
Let me just say, it's good that we still have checks and balances in this country. I mean, Trump's assault on the media, large parts of the media, is really about delegitimizing an institution, which is about checks and balances at its best. And it was good to see just, I think, hours ago, the Ninth Circuit, again, enjoined the Muslim ban. So there's push and pull. And I think those checks and balances, what everyone thinks of Trump seeking good public opinion, good press, are the important things to sustain and strengthen.
I don't think it's delegitimizing the media. He slavishly craves its approval. That's the problem.
Come on, fake news. If he disagrees with it, calling it fake news.
Fake news is an annoying concept, and I don't use it. But I noticed a falsehood in the New York Times just today. They said that DACA recipients have to have gotten a high school degree. No, they don't. They have to be attending a high school, which can be an online course in English and second language. So there is a grain of truth behind fake news.
Trump has a pickup Ross? Artist's relationship to the mainstream media. he thinks that by negging them, I guess us, since I work for the mainstream media, mm-hmm. us. Is this a mainstream media radio show?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So us. In nagging us, he will ultimately, win our hearts and affection. I think that that's unquestionably the case. If you look at his entire approach to my own newspaper, where it's furious attacks on Twitter and exclusive interviews with my colleagues the next day suggest that this is a man who may do damage to the media, but he's not a man with a master plan to delegitimize it and replace it all with Fox and Friends. He dreams of it.
I would say
he opens the New York Times and they say,
but Ross,
Trump
put
is
aside
awesome.
The New York Times. Put aside the New York Times for a moment. Go to this Press Freedom Tracker. I mean, there's serious issues of assault on actual journalists, on journalism going on in this country. I don't get as alarmist
Antifa,
as some
right?
of my
no,
colleages.
I completely
and
agree.
I think it is. Yeah, no, I don't consider, it's not a left-right thing. I really do think that a strong media is at the fundamental root of a strong democracy and an accountability, public, watchdog, independent media.
I think a really telling thing from this week was apparently the president told Nancy Pelosi, he was sort of marveling to her about how favorable the media coverage had been of the deal that he made with Democrats. And he said even Fox News was favorable about it. There was this amazing rant from Lou Dobbs on Fox Business Network attacking Paul Ryan as a rhino because Paul Ryan wouldn't make a deal with Democrats over the debt ceiling and that Democrats have calmed themselves and become so much more reasonable toward the president in the last few weeks. And why can't it was
vertigo.
It was bonkers. It was Orwellian. But the thing is, it reflects how the media will sort of define what a Republican is supposed to be around whatever the president does. And so I think if the president makes this pivot and works more with Democrats, I think he will keep most of his media fans with him and most of his base with him. Now, he won't keep Breitbart. He won't keep Ann Coulter and various other people who really, who really care a lot about the specifics of immigration
policy.
He'd
keep Breitbart on other issues, though. He'd lose Breitbart if he made a deal on immigration, but he'd keep Breitbart if he made a deal on tax reform, for instance.
He's transactional when he comes to the media.
Economics.
I'd like to see him have a rally where he says, and you know what? I got the Dreamers amnesty. And see how they applaud. That's what he lives for. That's the only counterweight to his love of the mainstream
but
media.
Don't forget,
he loves his rallies, and he's going to have to hold a rally, and he's going to get a lot of grief.
I think they might applaud it.
I mean, he can do that, but a week or so earlier, he pardoned Sheriff Arpaio. That rally, which CNN showed unfiltered, I believe, or maybe it was Fox, reminded me of those campaign rallies where the media did not elect Donald Trump, but it abetted his rise, and those media moguls talk about it.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, Ross Douthat of The New York Times, and Mickey Kaus of CastFiles.com. I'm going to come back with this panel and then Emily Yoffe to discuss Betsy DeVos's announcement about sex assault on campus. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist for The New York Times. And our special guest is Mickey Kaus, political blogger at Kaus Files. I want to get to one last topic with our panel, which is the Russia investigation. Donald Trump Jr. gave an interview behind closed doors this week to the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said he never informed his father of that meeting with the Russians claiming to have damaging information about Hillary Clinton last June. And he said he didn't know anything about his father being involved in drafting his first misleading statement about what happened in that meeting when it became public several weeks ago. Ross, what do you make of Don Jr.'s I don't know anything about anything routine?
I mean, it's totally plausible since he doesn't give the appearance of knowing anything about anything. I honestly cannot tell. I know that that's sort of a cop out of an answer. But the ins and outs and sort of the combination of the the different leaks coming about where the investigation is, I just can't tell. I can't assess the significance of the Don Jr. role right at the moment, effectively, I don't think. I think there's too much sort of murk around it. And sort of what we, with Trump and company, there's a certain amount of sort of malice and dishonesty and a certain amount of incompetence, and I can't tell where the balance is. I've sort of given up, and I'm waiting for Robert Mueller to sort of answer it all for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see indictments for financial money laundering, for financial. I mean, this began as collusion. We'll see. But I'm struck, as the media kind of strikes out on some things, and it's worth reading Leonid Bershitsky, in Bloomberg about this lawyer Trump Jr. met with, Veselnitskaya. I mean, she's sort of a third-tier lawyer for third-tier oligarchs. She's made out to be something much more. But I'm struck by the Facebook and the Russian story that has come out in the last hours, days. I mean, so unnamed Russians bought $100,000 in political ads on a variety of subjects that ran over a two-year period from about June 2015 to May 2017. And this somehow influenced the 2016 U.S. election. I don't, by way of putting this in perspective, I know group associated with spent $30,000 on a Facebook campaign that ran for 3 weeks in 2016 and barely got 1,000 click-throughs. I don't get, Facebook responsible for the outcome of the election?
Well,
there's a resilience.
Is anyone saying that this caused the outcome of the election?
Well, Margaret Sullivan, someone I admire, I read it at 7 a.m. this morning, her column in the Washington Post, she does credit this Facebook with playing a role, a really important role. To me, we need media literacy in this country, but there's a resilience among people. And the idea that this swayed the election in some serious way is something to think hard about. But it's on the front pages of papers and it's being bandied about. But let the investigation go on. I just think it's going to end up much more about money laundering, Manafort probably being indicted, one or two others, maybe Trump Jr.
Mickey, this is in line with an email that Ty Cobb, the White House lawyer, sent to this British email scammer who keeps emailing these people around Trump, pretending to be other people around Trump from email addresses that literally come from @emailscammer.co.uk. But these people are not paying close attention. And Ty Cobb wrote back basically saying he's confident that the White House is in the clear here, but that the probe's going to go on for a long time because Mike Flynn and Paul Manafort have their own problems.
Well, that seems reasonable. The more Mueller focuses on things we already know about, like this ridiculous Trump meeting, the more I'm convinced maybe there's nothing else there. And if there's nothing else there, I think Trump is going to skate. The great fear is that there's some great hidden conspiracy that we don't know about. And the more he focuses on the pathetic little things we know about, that means the less he has to go on.
Mickey, we just learned about this meeting not that long ago, and it was it was shocking at that point. And I think most people, until we saw those emails with Don Jr.
Like
setting up that meeting, people wouldn't have believed it happened.
I have sort of the opposite view. Yeah, to me, the more there's signs that they're actually focused on stuff related to Don Jr. and Kushner and so on, the more serious it is for the White House. And the more they're focused, as Katrina suggests, on, the financial crimes that undoubtedly people in Trump's outer orbit have committed,
absolutely,
the more I think this ends up with some indictments. And then Trump is able to say, but look, I'm clean. It was a witch hunt. I mean, to me,
we've reached
to sort of my that meeting was the first time I really thought there might be fire rather than smoke that would touch Trump himself. And I still, don't know if there is. But that's, yeah, I think if it's on Don Jr., it's close enough to Trump to burn, where if it's on Mike Flynn, it's not.
Flynn, it's not.
I'm going to ask our panel to sit back for a minute while I introduce a new guest for a segment we've been calling It's Been Busy. The idea is we've all been so busy talking about the latest shocking developments in the news, we often don't get to focus on some of the really important things that have been happening. So on Thursday, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced controversial plans to revisit controversial guidance set by the Obama administration regarding campus sexual assault enforcement. Joining us now to help us understand the context of this announcement is Emily Yaffe, who's writing a series of articles for The Atlantic about these rules. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
So first, before we get to what changes the Trump administration might make, can you describe for listeners what the Obama-era changes were and what effect they've had?
The Obama administration, in what was obviously a worthy goal of addressing campus sexual assault, saying schools had been handling this badly and haphazardly, so they were going to put some muscle behind it, released a series of guidelines, usually in the form of a Dear Colleague letter to every college in the country saying, things are going to change. There are new rules on campus. We're going to back them up with enforcement by our Office for Civil Rights. And among the changes that happened in 2011 were all schools were told any campus sexual assault adjudication must be handled using preponderance of the evidence. That means generally means 50.01% more likelihood that someone was responsible. There were severe limitations put on the ability of the accused to question the accuser. The accused often didn't know who witnesses against him were. And another thing that happened was a tremendous, vast expansion of the definitions of what sexual misconduct was. Could include telling, being flirtatious or telling sexy jokes to someone who didn't want to hear it. A new rule called affirmative consent was put in place on many campuses, which means each touch, each time two people have sex, even if they're in an ongoing relationship, must get preferably verbal approval. So it was just a sea change as far as rules, rules of behavior, rules of adjudication, investigation, and punishment.
So the argument for these rules has generally been sexual assault is much more common both generally and on campus than people have realized, that a large majority of the accusations that are made are true, but that most of them don't result or did not result in any sort of punishment, in part because the sort of adversarial courtroom style adjudication process had put too much of a burden on complainants in these cases, and that basically these changes were needed in order to have a fair environment for sexual assault victims. Would you say that's a fair description of the motivation? And then what do you think the actual effect has been?
Yes, that is a fair description. I take issue with some of the assumptions in the description. No doubt more sexual assault of all kinds happens than is reported. But the kickoff was with the assertion that 1 in 5 young women will be the victim of sexual assault during their time at college. This was based on a single study of a few unnamed colleges through online surveys that were anonymous. And the lead author, I spoke to the lead author of the survey that was used to make what is a horrifying statement about the danger of campuses, and he said, "My survey cannot be used in this way. You cannot generalize it to every campus in the country." In addition, I and many other people have looked at these surveys, and often the questions are ambiguous, leading, potentially misleading. So we really don't know what the number is. Many people I spoke to over the years truly believe campuses are a safe place for women, and government surveys of crime on and off campus show that young people who are college age but not in college are more likely to be the victims of crime than of all sorts, including sexual crime, than people who are at college. Crime has been falling dramatically for decades in this country, and that includes young people.
So one of the motivations for the Trump administration revisiting this has been a number of these sort of horror stories that have come out from campuses of this new adjudication process going a little bit off the rails.
Right. And there are horror stories. I've written about them.
So isn't it sort of awkward that the people who are revisiting this and making the argument that these standards are essentially overbroad and overly stringent on sexual assault, that we have, you know, a president of the United States who bragged about grabbing women by the pussy. We have a secretary of education with dubious credentials for the job whose nomination was confirmed on a vote that had to be tie-broken by the vice president of the United States because he couldn't even get all the Republicans in the Senate to vote for Betsy DeVos. Are these really the right people to be revisiting these standards?
That is a really important point. And as I've been working on these stories for a long time, and as Donald Trump was elected and then all this was happening, there is a, I understand, and I've written about the cognitive dissonance of this. I think Donald Trump's election is a disaster for this country, and yet I was listening to his Secretary of Education yesterday give her speech about how things have to be changed, and I found myself agreeing with much of it. As I say in the piece, I fear one of the dangers about this is because it's coming from the Trump administration, it will be perceived from the get-go as illegitimate. And you're already seeing that. This has become kind of the latest political proxy war. What's going to end up happening is that more young people's lives are smashed up. Not just young men. Young women are very badly hurt by this system, too. And, boy, if anything needed, people of goodwill on all sides to say, what we have doesn't work. How do we make it better? It's this, and I fear that won't happen.
Is there any way to make these systems work well? It sort of seems to me when you look at this, most of these cases are going to have no useful physical evidence because most of them describe people who are at least acquaintances or even in relationships. There's no dispute about that these people had sex. Most of them are going to have no witnesses to the act that's in dispute. It seems like it's going to be impossible to design a system for these colleges to use that consistently punishes the guilty and also consistently exonerates the innocent. Is there a good way to handle this?
I think you pointed out the essential problems. But I do think fixing this needs to be done at the procedural level, but also at the cultural level. We are now at a time, I quote two Harvard law professors, wrote a terrific article called The Sex Bureaucracy, in which they say, right now, virtually any sexual encounter that happens on campus is a potential violation. And young people are told, look out for this, report this, report rumors. You know, if you look back on an experience you don't like, even if it was 2 years later, report it. I think culturally we have to make a shift so that when we do, when administrators do look into, investigate, and adjudicate cases, they are doing so with cases where there genuinely is a belief that perhaps something wrong happened. Right now, we have a system where any complaint provokes this mechanism. And I think that has to change. And young people also have to, we have to change the training and the assumptions that everyone is under constant threat of being attacked.
Emily Offey, contributing editor at The Atlantic, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Josh. Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Katrina VandenHeuvel, what's your rant?
This coming week brings Hillary Clinton's new book, and many will be relitigating 2016. Yeah, shocker. The book does take some swipes at Bernie Sanders, but I'm not looking backwards. Seems to me a moment to understand how Sanders' campaign and the ascendant populist wing inside the Democratic Party have moved it on core economic issues. Sanders unveils his Medicare for All bill on Wednesday. Senator Warren, Kamala Harris are sponsors. It's becoming the de facto center of debate over healthcare policy going forward, a stunning reversal from just a few years ago.
Mickey Kaus, it's your soapbox.
Douglas Holtz-Eakin, a prominent conservative economist and a pro-immigration one, says there's no way that the Dreamers can compete with low-wage Americans who are already here, especially Blacks and Hispanics, or including Blacks and Hispanics, because the Dreamers have so many skills. He obviously hasn't looked at who the Dreamers are. 20% are high school dropouts. True, 20% are college graduates, but they are an average population. And those who don't have very many skills are going to be competing with low-wage Americans, and they're going to be lowering their wages by over-flooding the market with more supply.
Ross Douthat, what's on your mind?
This week, a Trump judicial nominee, Amy Barrett, a Catholic and mother of seven, was subjected to a very striking line of questioning from Democratic senators about the link between her Catholic faith and her generally fairly conventional conservative judicial positions, which culminated in a particularly strange line from Senator Dianne Feinstein of California saying, "Oh, reading your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you." And this was something that lots of Catholics seized on, and I think rightly, as evidence that as America becomes a less religious country, which it seems to be, traditional religious faith in all its forms will be regarded with a particular kind of suspicion by people who once would have accepted conservative Catholics as normal American political actors.
For my rant, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said something so nuts in an interview with New York Magazine this week, I had to go back and read it twice. He said, "I think people all over the city of every background would like to have the city government be able to determine which building goes where, how high it will be, who gets to live in it, what the rent will be. I think there's a socialistic impulse, which I hear every day in every kind of community, that they would like things to be planned in accordance with their needs, and I would too." He went on to say, "Look, if I had my druthers, the city government would determine every single plot of land, how development would proceed." Now, really? Like, you want, like, this level of central planning over real estate? The funny thing is that Bill de Blasio's actual administration has pursued fairly normal and reasonable development policies that have encouraged the construction of housing, that have allowed a private market in real estate to flourish while trying to bolster housing affordability in much the way that a lot of other mayors around the country are approaching this. In practice, Bill de Blasio seems fine on this, but he seems to be expressing that he'd like some nutty communist thing if he had his druthers. That's all we have time for today, but before we go, we want to welcome a new member of the Left, Right, and Center family. Rich and Vanessa Lowry, congratulations on your new baby boy. Thanks to Katrina Vandenhoevel, Ross Douthat, Mickey Kaus, Haley Bird, and Emily Yaffe. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.